The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating more than a half century of promoting awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. This podcast is brought to you through the generous financial support of the Tongyang Group. In the areas of financial services and manufacturing, the companies of the Tongyang Group harness the passion and creativity of 12,000 employees worldwide to better serve their clients. The Tongyang Group, a global partner for Korean business. On February 10, 2011, the Korea Society's Korea In-Depth Lecture Series hosted Professor Charles K. Armstrong, Director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University, for a lecture entitled North-South Korean Issues. Armstrong explored the history of conflict and cooperation between North and South Korea from the time the two contemporary Korean states were established in 1948 until the present day. The 2011 Korea In-Depth Lecture Series by noted scholars of the history, politics, literature, art, and architecture of Korea is supported by a grant from the New York Council for the Humanities.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome. Welcome to the Korea Society, and I'm Mark Minton, the president of the Korea Society, and I thank you all. It's an impressive gathering tonight. I thank you all for coming out and helping us inaugurate a new series here, which we call Korea In Depth. And the idea is to offer a program, series of programs, six in all, over a period of as many weeks on Thursday evening, roughly the same time every Thursday evening, so people can get used to the pattern, which will provide a course on Korea. Now, if you were to complete the whole series, and we would strongly recommend that or encourage you to think about it, your MA in Korean Studies would still be an honorary one, but you would have, in fact, looked through several windows into Korean history, culture, society. The programs are quite varied. Tonight, of course, we're starting with a program on, I would say, recent Korean history, North and South, and the implications of that, which still have a great effect not only on the Korean Peninsula, but internationally as well. But subsequent programs and other Thursday evenings up through March 17th will be on such varied topics as old maps from Korea or and of Korea, the Sokoram, which of course many of you know as the great statuary cave actually in Gyeongju of Buddhist iconography and sculpture. And we have another program also on the Korean War coming up with Professor Ledyard. I see you're in the audience. Thank you for coming tonight. You can read all about it literally in this calendar that we have for all Korea Society programs for the next 4 months till the end of April, and they're out on the front desk. But tonight it's my special pleasure to introduce Dr. Charles Armstrong from Columbia University. I'm going to read a little bit of the many honors and publications that Charles has because there are so many that are hard to remember. But he is has his PhD from the University of Chicago. He is the Korea Foundation Associate Professor of Korean Studies in the Social Sciences in the Department of History at Columbia University and Director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. He's also a frequent commentator both on the history, especially the recent history of the Korean Peninsula, North and South. But he is also the author of many, many books, The Koreas, The North Korean Revolution, Korea at the Center, Dynamics of Regionalism in Northeast Asia, Korean Society, Civil Society, Democracy, and the State, and so forth and so on. And many, many articles, too many to mention. It's also a very special pleasure for me to welcome Charles back to the Korea Society. He's a frequent guest here, and that has entirely to do with quality. But he is also an old friend, a longtime friend and colleague. I remember Charles very fondly from the days I was a U.S. diplomat, and I was a more junior diplomat, and he was a more junior academic at Columbia. But in the late 90s, Charles was instrumental in helping us bring some of our quiet private talks, some of the first we really had in depth with the North Koreans, to Columbia University, where we were able to, we thought at first, have them out of the glare of publicity. Later, the press caught on. But it was a pleasure meeting Charles then, and it's been an even greater pleasure following his distinguished academic career since then, in the last decade or so. So may I therefore introduce for the program on North-South Korean issues tonight, Dr. Charles Armstrong.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you for your kind introduction. As Mark said, we first met in the late 90s. It was actually just after my first year at Columbia University. I just gotten out of my PhD, and I was minding my own business, doing archival research, when the director of the Weatherhead, now the Weatherhead, then the East Asian Institute, sent me an email saying, you know, the North and South Koreans are going to be meeting at Columbia, and you'd better get involved. This is the first I had heard of it, and I looked into it and met Mark and the rest of the U.S. delegation who were involved in the preparatory four-party talks, or the talks to prepare for the four-party talks among North and South Korea, China, and the United States. It was a fascinating experience to be kind of on the outside looking in. But I have to say, although Mark used the word instrumental, my main contribution to peace on the Korean Peninsula so far in my career has been to arrange a luncheon on the Columbia campus for the delegates of the four parties, which may or may not be a significant contribution, but they did seem to like the lunch, so I guess I could be pleased with what I had done there. Anyway, it's a pleasure to be here, and I was very pleased that Mark Minton became head of the Korea Society, and that this organization is in his capable hands. And I was happy to take his invitation to be the first speaker in the series. There are some people in the audience who are very knowledgeable of this subject, indeed more knowledgeable than I am in some respects. And so my apologies if my lecture is a little oversimplified, but I understand that this is a more of a general audience on the whole. So I will couch my lecture in terms of an overview of this recent history. I would like to speak for only about 45-50 minutes. I'd like to end at 7:30. I'm sure there will be many questions and much to discuss, and I'd like to leave sufficient time for that discussion. As you can see, divided Korea is still a problem very much with us today. On the left is a map of Korea as it looks, a political map in which you have two states on the Korean Peninsula separated by the DMZ, the Demilitarized Zone. And my apologies to those in the audience who will object to the naming of the sea on the right side of the map, the Sea of Japan, but that is, for better or for worse, the standard usage in English for what the Koreans call the East Sea. And on the right, of course, we all know, I think, what that is, and that is the aftermath of the shelling of Yeonpyeong Island last November by North Korean artillery. Divided Korea seems to be a relic of the Cold War, yet here we are 20 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union, after the unification of Germany, after the unification of Vietnam well before that, and Korea still remains divided, with the exception of the division between mainland China and Taiwan, which is a somewhat different type of division. North-South division is the last of the Cold War divided nations that remain with us. What I'd like to go over tonight is an overview of how that came to be, why that is the case, how Korea became divided, why Korea remains divided, why division persists. I'd like to spend some time focusing on various attempts to overcome division, particularly through dialogue and interaction between North and South Korea, and the implications of divided Korea for the present international scene and going into the future. To begin with, how did Korea become divided? The division of Korea was a product of the end of World War II. It was never expected to be a permanent division. It was more of an ad hoc, last-minute decision by the victorious allies, primarily the United States, with the cooperation of the Soviet Union. The idea of what to do with the Japanese colony of Korea came up in various conferences as World War II came to its end. We have this is a photo on top of the big three, Churchill, FDR, and Stalin, at the Yalta Conference in 1943, which is was primarily focused on the disposition of Europe after the German surrender, but also brought up the subject of the possibility of Allied intervention in the former colonies of Japan, including the largest and most important being Korea. On the bottom, there are a couple of old photos of the men who ultimately became the first leaders of the two Korean states, Syngman Rhee or Lee Sung-man in the center on the left, with John Hodge, the commander of U.S. forces and the head of the U.S. military government in Korea on the right. And the right-hand picture shows Kim Il-sung with the chopsticks having dinner with, I believe that is Romanenko, one of the leading Soviet generals. And then on the far left, does anybody recognize that man? Anybody know the man in the headband in the hanbok with the glasses? Cho-man-sik, yes. Cho-man. Yeah, Cho-man-sik, who was the leading nationalist figure in the Pyongan region. I will get in a moment to his fate. With the defeat of Germany, the next question would be, in the, as the summer of 1945 progressed, what to do with Japan, whose defeat was also apparently imminent. The Soviet Union had been neutral since 1941 in the war with Japan. And the American interest was in getting the Soviet Union to cooperate in the war in order to speed its end. There was, of course, concern on the part of the Americans that there would be a long and protracted war with the Japanese, including an invasion of the home islands, which could be an extremely bloody venture. And some of the war plans suggested that this war could go on well into the fall of 1945, perhaps in October or so, causing hundreds of thousands of casualties before the Japanese ultimately surrendered. As we know, of course, this is not the scenario that played out. On August 6th of 1945, the U.S. dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, and 2 days later, the Soviet Union declared war on Japan. August 9th, the bomb was dropped on Nagasaki, and it was quite evident that Japanese surrender would happen in a matter of days. The problem, as the Americans saw it, was that the Soviet Union was already in the region, and their ability to sweep down through Northeast Asia into the Korean Peninsula was far greater than the American ability to enter Korea from the Pacific. The question that the American war leadership had to face is what to do about the possibility that the Soviet Union would have control and domination over the entire Korean Peninsula. This was seen as something to be avoided, if at all possible. On the night of August 10th through 11th, 1945, the State War Naval Coordinating Committee in Washington discussed what to do with Korea and discussed in particular how to divide responsibility with the Soviet Union and to have a role for the United States in Korea after World War II, after the Japanese surrender. The story goes that two junior officers in the military, Charles Bonesteel and Dean Rusk, the latter of whom became later Secretary of State, and this is according to Rusk's testimony later, were given the assignment of figuring out how to divide Korea, and they looked at a National Geographic map of the Korean Peninsula, did not see any obvious natural boundaries that could separate Korea between the North and the South, and decided on a line of latitude, which roughly divided Korea in half, but very importantly gave Seoul the capital to the American side in the South. That line was the 30th parallel, 38 degrees north latitude. And this was communicated to the Soviet leadership. And somewhat to the surprise, it seems, of the Americans, the Soviet Union agreed to this division, that Soviets would take the Japanese surrender down to the 30th parallel, and the Americans would accept the Japanese surrender from the south up to the 30th parallel. Part of the reason, it seems, that the Soviet Union agreed to this was that Stalin expected to have a share in the occupation of Japan, and specifically to occupy all or part of the northern island of Hokkaido. This turned out not to be the case, and the occupation of Japan was essentially a unilateral American venture. But for whatever reasons, Stalin agreed to this division of Korea. As I said, this was not expected to be a permanent division. This was a temporary expedience to accept the Japanese surrender, to establish a presence of both American and Soviet forces on the ground in Korea so that the Soviets would not have complete control over the peninsula, which could then be potentially a security threat to Japan in the future. And therefore, there would be elections held in which there would be a unified Korean government over the entire peninsula. Perhaps Professor Ledger, when he talks about the Korean War, can go into more of this detail. It's a very complicated story. My PhD advisor, Bruce Cummings at Chicago, wrote a 700-page PhD dissertation on this, which became a 1,100 or so page book. So obviously there's a lot of detail that I'm going to have to skip over. And that's only one scholar. There are many other contending opinions about this. But essentially, briefly, the Soviet and American sides could not agree on the form of a post-war Korean government, a liberated Korean government. There were three meetings held between the Soviet and American officials, two in Korea, one in Moscow. And in the meantime, there were political forces on the ground in Korea who were coalescing around the respective occupation governments, the Americans, of course, in Seoul, and the Soviets having their headquarters in Pyongyang, the largest city in the north. Initially, the Soviets worked through this man in the bottom right picture, Cho Man-sik, until early 1946, when he opposed the outcome of the Moscow conference of Soviet, American, and British delegates about Korea, which was that there would be a period of several years of trusteeship in which there would be a joint occupation, and then the Koreans would be given eventual independence. Many Koreans, needless to say, opposed that. Cho Man-sik was one of them, and for his outspoken opposition was put under house arrest and then disappeared sometime in the early stages of the Korean War. In the end, it turned out that the Soviet supported leader of the North would be the young guerrilla fighter Kim Il-sung, who was also a resident of Pyongyang. Initially, interestingly enough, from the Soviet documents, we've seen that the Soviets wanted Kim Il-sung to work with Cho Man-sik as his junior in a new political party, but Kim had bigger ambitions for himself and became the head of the northern branch of the Korean Communist Party and then the head of the new government of the North. Elections were held ultimately after things fell apart in terms of agreements between the two sides. Under UN auspices, the U.S. handed over the issue of Korea to the UN in 1947, and elections were held in 1948, which the North Koreans and the Soviets refused to recognize, So an independent government was established in the south alone, and then 3 weeks later, a new government was established in the north. As a consequence, you had two governments, each claiming to be the legitimate government of all of the Korean Peninsula. As has been said, the Koreans left and right, or north and south, might not agree on anything else except that there should be a single unified Korea. And the result, almost inevitably, was a military conflict, a civil war, which became an internationalized war through the intervention of the UN forces led by the United States and then by the Chinese. There's still more. History never ends. And when we think we've found the definitive answer to this, more comes out. And there's still more. I've just been reviewing in the last few days a new manuscript written by a Russian scholar that reveals new insights into the Soviet and North Korean side of the Korean War. The war was, of course, a devastating experience for Koreans on both sides. Millions were killed, injured, or displaced. The atomic bomb was almost used. It was seriously considered by Truman, and it involved a massive intervention of Chinese forces, as well as, of course, the Americans and their allies. But the greatest tragedy of the war for the long term might be seen as its lack of resolution, that the Korean division was not resolved by the war. And the result of the war, as we know, was not a peace agreement, but an armistice, a cessation to the hostilities and the division along a line, not exactly at the 30th parallel, but very close to it, the zigzag line called the demilitarized zone. This also was supposed to be a temporary measure, after which a political solution was supposed to be reached in a year and a half. The sides involved in the Korean conflict, as well as the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was not officially a belligerent in the war, but a force behind the scenes. But they also came to the conference held in April of 1954 in Geneva, which also resulted in an impasse. And this has been a recurrent theme now for 60 years. And why that is the case, I don't have an answer. Maybe some of you might have. But attempts to solve the Korean problem never seemed to reach agreement. And that was true in the initial division, in the Geneva conferences, and in every meeting since then. So division became solidified in a very literal sense. Massive military forces on both sides of the DMZ, barbed wire, booby traps, mines, and the introduction of tactical nuclear weapons from the late 1950s on the American side until the early 1990s. Nevertheless, despite this solidification of division, which was also reflective of a general global division, one of the great pioneering scholars of Korean studies, Gregory Henderson, who was a diplomat in South Korea in the late 40s, wrote a book or edited a book called Divided Nations in a Divided World. And Korea was very much a divided nation in a divided world, which seemed to reflect, to embody the bipolar division of the Cold War itself. Which again brings that question I set out at the beginning. Why does Korea remain divided when the Cold War is now increasingly distant history in the past? I'll try to get to that toward the end. Korea, in its division, did seem to reflect the geopolitical dynamics of the Cold War. And when the bipolarity of the Cold War began to erode in the late 1960s, that also had an effect on the Korean Peninsula. But the most dramatic change in the East Asian dynamic of the Cold War was the rapprochement between the United States and China. And this finally led to the first real breakthrough in North-South relations, the first of four major openings, which I'll talk about there on your sheet. The first was in a direct response to the Sino-Soviet rapprochement, The Kissinger visit to China, and then later Nixon in China. Wonderful opera. Perhaps there'll be an opera of Park Chung-hee and Kim Il-sung too someday, although they didn't actually meet. But Kim Dae-jung in Pyongyang, that would be a nice opera. The communique of July 4th of 1972, which was the first agreement between North and South Korea to engage in dialogue, to try to find a peaceful way out of this impasse and to move toward unification. The July 4th communique was very brief. It didn't outline a lot of specifics. There were a series of meetings held between various officials after that. But by the summer of 1973, these talks began to break down, and the North eventually pulled out completely, and the talks collapsed. Nothing much happened, at least at the official level, for another 12 years. And then a kind of unexpected event triggered a new set of talks, and that was a flooding in the South, in which the South Korean side asked for economic assistance, which sounds really astonishing today, from the North. The North gave cement and other materials. And this led to a series of exchanges between the respective Red Crosses of both sides and an exchange of cultural troops for the first time, as well as official talks that went on for a year or so. Once again, however, this momentum did not continue, and the two sides returned to the old habits of mutual acrimony and hostility. It was not helped by the run-up to the 88 Olympics in Seoul, in which in 1987 a Korean Air passenger plane exploded, and North Korean agents were held responsible for that, which was the event that put North Korea eventually in 1989 on the terrorists list of the U.S. State Department, where it remained until the Bush administration. The next opening was with the end of the Cold War itself, and that again changed the dynamic of the Korean Peninsula as well. And this led to, and I won't go into the details of this, the second and a much more extensive signed agreement on both sides, the Basic Agreement on Cooperation and Reconciliation. Whoops, I have cooperation there twice. Sorry, exchange and cooperation, as well as an agreement on denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula in February of 1992. This was a very different time, however, from the early 1970s. 20 years before, there seemed a real possibility of cross-recognition, a certain kind of equality between the two sides of North and South Korea. But the early 1990s was a time in which North Korea appeared to be an anachronistic holdover of a system that was about to die. And many in South Korea, in the West, and elsewhere believed that North Korea would itself soon be history. And that was, in part, the kind of background that made this possible. But this also fell apart, and this time one of the major factors in this was the first nuclear crisis of 1993 to 1994, in which North Korea was accused of diverting spent nuclear fuel to make weapons, threatened to pull out of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and the U.S. and North Korea came very close to open hostilities in the summer of 1994. That was the worst moment until perhaps very recently, between the Korean War and now in the state of conflict on the Korean Peninsula. In the late 1990s, there was a shift once again, which had to do with, first of all, the changing relationship between the United States and North Korea, which Mark Minton was very instrumental in working out, as well as the coming to power of a new government in South Korea under Kim Dae-jung, who put engagement with North Korea at the center of his policies. And the symbolic peak of that was the June 15th summit meeting in 2000 between the leaders of North and South, Kim Dae-jung and Kim Jong-il. There was another summit meeting, of course, in October of 2007. But we can see this period, I think, this decade or so, as a high point of possibility and of real interaction between North and South Korea. Another way to look at this, if we look at the four openings, is also the corresponding stages of North-South relations. The first was a stage of no contact at all from 1948 to 1972, a period of on-again, off-again talks for 20 years, a period of relatively cautious opening in the early Kim Dae-jung administration, and then a period of deepening economic linkages, of setting up of tourism, of economic cooperation ventures, and of human exchange. And I think this should not be forgotten. North Korea has not been completely isolated from the South, or vice versa. There were considerable numbers of academic exchanges, visits, mostly, of course, from the South to the North. But there was a feeling of real expectation that this would be a breakthrough, that even unification of a kind of cooperation between both sides was a real possibility. And I think that was the first time since the Korean War that feeling was so widespread. Since 2008, and I'll get back to this toward the end, that we may be in another stage of a return to confrontation. Maybe it will continue. Maybe it's reached its peak last year. That remains to be seen. Again, just to reiterate, to go back to this first stage, and let me go through these stages one by one. We might call this first period one of existential antagonism, that each side understood the other as a threat to its very existence, they refused to recognize each other's legitimacy as political entities. They reflected, as I said, the regional and global Cold War divide, the bipolarity of the world of the Cold War, which seemed very neat at the time, although, as we know, the relations on the communist side were much more complex than they appeared in the 1960s. It ended, as I said, with Nixon's visit to China and U.S.-China reconciliation, and it opened up these talks that led to the July 4th community. If we look kind of at the trend of it, we see this movement toward a cautious coexistence. The talks broke down, as I said, in the summer of 73. Exchanges took place again in the mid-80s. But what also changed is this shift in economic position between North and South. It's also, I think, useful to keep in mind that North Korea was not always the economic basket case that we see it today. And indeed, in the late 1950s, North Korea was something of an economic miracle. It may have had the highest rates of industrial growth in the world in the late 1950s, in the period of reconstruction after the Korean War. And it was South Korea that was seen, particularly by the Americans, as an economic basket case until perhaps the mid-1960s, when it began to get on its feet. But the 1980s was a very dramatic period of economic shift toward the South from the North, and there are various interpretations of how and why this took place. My own view was that the decisive moment came in the mid-1960s, and it had to do with both North and South Korea changing their economic policy. South Korea, which is the more well-known story, focusing on rapid economic growth and export-oriented growth under Park Chung-hee, which became, in the course of the 1970s and 1980s, one of the great economic success stories of the modern age. But North Korea also took an economic shift in a way in the other direction in its policy, which was in about 1966, what the North Koreans called a policy of equal emphasis, in which they would put equal resources into the military and the civilian economy. There was considerable debate within North Korea about this, but those who wanted to emphasize greater militarization won out, and those who wanted to emphasize greater diversification and orientation toward consumer economic production lost, and North Korea began to decline in its economic growth, although not actually go into a negative economic condition. But that was the point at which I think North Korea's economic decline relative to the South became ultimately irreversible. There's also, although I talked about Kim Dae-jung in the late 1990s, of course, before him there was No Tae-woo from the late 80s to the early 90s, who had a policy of what he called northern politics or northern policy, which reached out toward communist countries on the Asian mainland and in Europe, but also had a component of reaching out to North Korea as well, and built upon South Korea's already very impressive economic achievements to and combined with the Eastern Bloc's desire to improve their own economies, which were encountering increasing difficulties, to win, if not friends, at least cooperative partners in the Eastern Bloc. Finally, as I've said, the end of the Cold War and the North-South Basic Agreement of 91-92 culminated that phase of movement toward cautious coexistence. Now, the 1990s was a complex kind of roller coaster period of ups and downs on the Korean Peninsula. There was, as we know, the first U.S.-North Korean nuclear crisis, of course, like World War I. They didn't think it was the first one because they did not anticipate the second, which occurred in the first decade of the 21st century, leading to an agreed framework between the U.S. and the DPRK North Korea in October of 1994, which very simply froze, to simplify the agreement, froze North Korea's nuclear program in exchange for energy assistance, or at least the plutonium program. There, as we were later to discover, there was another nuclear program that would emerge later on. That, in turn, kind of floundered after a couple of years until there was a new crisis in 1998 over North Korea's ballistic missiles, which led into a new series of talks with the U.S. and seemed to lead the U.S. and North Korea very close to a substantial breakthrough in diplomatic relations and even the possibility of normalization. At least that's what it appeared from the outside. Perhaps Mark has a different view of what really went on, but it did seem that the U.S. and North Korea were on the verge of a new relationship by 2000 after the June 15th summit and the visit of Vice Marshal Cho Myung-nok from North Korea to meet with Clinton and Secretary of State Madeleine Albright's visit to Pyongyang. Much of this momentum came to a screeching halt under the succeeding administration of George W. Bush, which involved a reevaluation of Korea policy, the infamous placement of North Korea in the axis of evil in the 2002 State of the Union address, and in October of 2002, accusations of a secret parallel uranium enrichment program. And finally, in 2003, North Korea withdrew from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which it only threatened to do in 1993-94. And it seemed once again we were on the verge of a serious conflict. The solution to this was the six-party talks, or at least that was the solution that the Chinese proposed as a way out of this impasse, which would involve more partners in this dialogue process. Beginning in April, South and North Korea, the U.S., China, Russia, and Japan would convene meetings, and they've all been in Beijing till now, to try to reach an agreement on North Korea's nuclear program, first of all, but also more generally to try to overcome this system of division of, or rather, perhaps more accurately, of alienation of North Korea from this growing cooperative state of affairs in Northeast Asia, to bring North Korea out of this economic and diplomatic marginalization and to put it on a more normal footing in its relations with its neighbors. the first serious breakthrough of that was the September 2005 Agreement on Principles. But every time it seemed there was a step forward in this, something would happen that would set things back. There were missile tests in 2006 and then the first North Korean nuclear test in October of 2007. There was yet another agreement on February 13th, despite this North Korean nuclear test. And that, too, did not lead very far. There was a second nuclear test in May of 2009 and sanctions imposed upon the UN that countered that. This, as I've said, is a very schematic kind of overview. We can talk more about the details of this complex process. And there are those in this room, I think, will have something to contribute to the discussion with their insights of many aspects of this. But where we are now, as I think most of us know, is uncertainty. The six-party talks have been suspended. North Korea has engaged in very provocative acts. They've been accused of sinking the South Korean naval ship, the Chonan. I say accused because although a international commission gave evidence or concluded that they were responsible, the North Koreans have vehemently denied responsibility, and the Chinese have tended to give them the benefit of the doubt on this, for better or for worse. And also the shelling of the island of Yeonpyeong in November of 2010 brought North-South relations and the North-South conflict to one of the highest levels that they've seen in many years. Where do we go from here as the two Koreas face the future? The last country divided by the Cold War. The Cold War, in a way, can no longer be the kind of excuse or rationale for why Korea remains divided, because the Cold War doesn't exist. Rather, Korean division has its own internal momentum, its own dynamic that has long outlasted the Cold War divide, which has its own roots in its history and in the intractability of the two systems that have emerged on both sides, embedded also in a regional system in which the external forces have not been able to reach agreement on how exactly to overcome the system of conflict and division. Over the period of increasing economic contact up until the last couple of years, and economic contact hasn't disappeared completely, but they've certainly gone down considerably. The expectation that many had that engagement, that the so-called sunshine policy, as the term was used in the early days of the Kim Dae-jung administration, the idea that this would lead to some sort of fundamental, substantial, even dramatic change in the North's political system turned out, at least for now, to be unfounded. The North hasn't changed. In some ways, the South changed more as a result of engagement policy, and the South Korean people's understanding and expectation of the North changed to a considerable extent. There had been a move toward a de facto peaceful coexistence of recognition of both sides. But at the same time, one of the things that this North-South contact impressed upon many, in South Korea at least, was that unification in the near future was not necessarily a desirable outcome. The unification of Germany had taught Koreans that this kind of unification of separated nations would have enormous, not only economic costs, which was very worrisome, but also cultural and social costs. And that this could set back Korea's own economic situation in the South for some time to come. And finally, and I think this is the biggest question of all of this, and in a way the key to the entire question of Korea's persistent division, is the North. When we talk about why Korea is still divided, often what we really mean by this is, why is North Korea still there? Why does North Korea exist? When all of these other countries with which North Korea seemed to have so much in common, all of the Eastern European communist states, are long gone. And I think that part of the reason for that is that North Korea is not really as much like those former Soviet bloc states as it appeared, that there is a kind of resilience and persistence in the North Korean system, rootedness in its own, in Korean conditions and history that is often underestimated. North Korea was not, at least not after its very initial formation, a satellite of the Soviet Union. It was in many ways a highly nationalistic and independent-minded state. But also North Korea lives in a different environment, adjacent to China, which has its own stake in perpetuating North Korea's continued viability. And North Korea is able to, in a remarkable way, maintain the viability of the regime, a certain rather extensive degree of social control, despite economic implosion in the mid to late 1990s. I want to conclude with this famous nighttime satellite photograph of the Korean Peninsula. And it's often used. It was first brought out, I think, by Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld in 2003. At least that he's the one who made this initially famous, to show how backward North Korea is, this dark mass surrounded by bright lights, particularly in contrast to South Korea. But I think it's worth keeping in mind, of course, this is reality. North Korea does have a severe energy shortage. There aren't a lot of lights operating in the north, and it is far, far poorer than the south. But it's worth keeping in mind the date of the photo, which is September of 2003, at a time when the North Koreans were very concerned that they would be next on the target list of an American invasion after the attack on Iraq. And there was a very high state of alert in North Korea and a kind of a blackout of the country. I'm not saying that's what's responsible for the blackness of North Korea, but I think we should not separate North Korea's economic problems, to say the least, from the kind of condition that it finds itself in a world that the North Korean leadership perceives as extremely hostile. How to bring North Korea out of that, how to light up the northern half of the peninsula, has been a problem vexing those dealing with North Korea for some time. But I don't think that this blackness itself should make us believe that North Korea is simply a non-entity that is going to disappear anytime soon. I think that for better or for worse, North Korea is with us for the foreseeable future, and that in some way we have to deal with it as people outside, whether in the South or in the United States or elsewhere. And only through that kind of interaction with the way the North really is, which is certainly not a very positive place in many ways, only through that can this division ultimately be overcome and the peninsula in some way integrated. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Charles. I think you built that as a basic lecture for a general audience, but I've been involved with the Korean Peninsula issues for at least 20 years and probably a little more than that. And there was a lot of food for thought in that presentation. And I'm sure we have a lot of questions and comments from the audience. I think if possible, we have a microphone here, and we have one that will migrate around with the help of some of my colleagues. And if you have a comment, if you could raise your hand, and Charles, just please recognize people, and we'll get a microphone to you, and I think it'd be helpful if you could identify yourself. Thank you.
We had a number of people back there.
My name is Philip Sherman. Mm-hmm. You discussed North Korea in a way that kind of assumes that it's a state like every other. Mm-hmm. You haven't, other than showing him eating rice with his chopsticks, talked at all about Kim Il-sung, and the idea that one might have that North Korea is actually a family business, a kind of l'état c'est moi approach. How does that factor into your thinking?
Well, North Korea has been run by the same family for 60 years. They're at the center of power, and I think that's one of the reasons it does exist, that system works in part because of that. How long it will work into the future is very hard to say, but I do think history matters. And when we hear a lot of speculation about Kim Jong-il's successor, his apparent successor, his son Kim Jong-un, that he can't keep the country together, it wouldn't hurt to go back to the discussions around the time of Kim Il-sung's death and the widespread belief that Kim Jong-il couldn't possibly pull this off, that you couldn't have a family dynasty in a communist country. I think North Korea has proved that you can. That's not a value judgment. That's not that to say that this is a good way to run a country, but it is the way North Korea is run. That's why I was not at all surprised, though some people were, including North Korea observers in the South, that it appeared that Kim Jong-un would come out as the heir apparent to Kim Jong-il, because I don't think the North Korean leadership knows any other way to run a country than to have a lineal descendant of the Kim family in charge. And yet, I don't think North Korea is a country like any other. I think North Korea is actually very unique, and that's one of the reasons it's still there when many countries which we thought were a lot like it are long gone.
Henry Segerman, International Investment Advisors. Most people look on the shelling of Yongpyeong as an absolute aggressive act, but from a historical perspective, could it be looked on as a backwash from the ending of the Korean War? The northern limit line was drawn by UN forces without it being part of the armistice agreement, and what it does is it hems in the North Korean coastline so that they're unable to get ships out of their only thawed out deep water port, Haeju, and it makes shipping extremely difficult for North Korea because they have to skirt around between the coastline and these islands, and they've always been very, very adamant about disagreeing with the northern limit line, and there can be no excuse for that type of violent action on their part, but I just wanted to ask if you felt that this recent provocation from a historical perspective, might be a kind of backwash.
Well, I wish I had a map of the northern limit line. It's a very interesting thing. It was not, you're right, it wasn't part of the armistice agreement. It was a unilateral line imposed by the UN command that went basically up the coast of North Korea. It doesn't extend straight out, but suddenly it veers in such a way that North Korea is, you know, strangled by this boundary. And, of course, the contestation over the waters, which are rich in crab and other maritime resources, has been going on for a long time. The Yongpyeong shelling was certainly not the first clash in that sea. Not even in the last year or so. There were two naval clashes in 2009. And I agree that we shouldn't excuse the North Korean action, but we should see it in the context of this this division which the North Koreans have not accepted. Now, they didn't say anything until the early 70s. In part because they were too busy rebuilding their country to be focused on these sorts of issues. But since the early 70s, they've continuously brought the issue up that the northern limit line is not, you know, a legitimate boundary. So there have been suggestions of how to resolve this. One would be to have a discussion among the UN command, the two Koreas, perhaps China, to establish the boundary or establish perhaps a kind of demilitarized area in the West Sea, possibly giving it over to the or reviving the military armistice command. That's been one suggestion. But I do think that we need to put this into a kind of context of a state of continuous tension and disagreement between North and South Korea, in which the North Korean side should be listened to, which is not to say that they're necessarily right, but that they have a certain point to make. In other words, I think it is good to have a discussion on these issues of contention because they clearly are contentious, and this one in particular. There is also background to the Yeonpyeong shelling itself, that instance which I won't get into in detail. And, you know, the North Koreans talked about the South Korean military exercises provoking them, which we may or may not accept. But nevertheless, when we have these kinds of military actions going on so frequently, in a way, what's surprising about the Korean situation is that there haven't been these sort of clashes more often. And certainly it would be beneficial for more dialogue, I think, about the issues of disagreement, such as the northern limit line. There's a woman back there who had her hand up.
Thank you for taking my question, Professor Armstrong. I was wondering if you could, you mentioned China, which of course has its own motivations in why it wants to keep the division intact between North and South Korea. But I was wondering if you could comment a little bit about whether you can see in the future North Korea taking on a policy that's more similar to China's in terms of market opening. Of course, the Kim dynasty notwithstanding, do you see a possibility of moving in that direction at any point in the future? Thanks.
Thank you. You know, I always remind people that I'm a historian, and yet they always ask me questions about the future. And as one of my teachers once said, I have enough trouble predicting the past, much less predicting the future. I might make this into a historical question. Could North Korea have taken a different route than it did? It seemed that it was moving in that direction in the early 2000s. And certainly the Chinese have not wasted any opportunity to lecture North Koreans to tell them that they should open up their economy and move in a market direction like themselves. It's more difficult for the North Koreans to do that for a number of reasons. First and foremost, probably because they fear the political consequences of a serious opening, given that South Korea is right there on their border, and that this could undermine the stability of the regime. Second, economic opening itself can have unpredictable consequences, as we've seen in the sort of crisis over the currency evaluation, which was then drawn back. Third, there are still very strong, I think, kind of ideological motivations within North Korea that resist this kind of marketization. I think that the reason that North Korea appeared to be moving in that direction around 2000, 2002 is precisely because they felt a greater security in their external environment and therefore were able to embark in these internal reforms. But when that changed, partly, of course, because of North Korea's own action, then they pulled back. And a lot of the reforms that were instituted in those early years of the last decade were, if not reversed, at least reduced after 2005. What will be interesting to see as things are going, North Korea has become more and more a dependency of China. And as that condition continues, North Korea may de facto be part of China's own economic reform process. And in that sense, I think North Korea could change economically. But politically, it will probably not change substantially. I don't know if I've answered your question. I mean, there's the question of the internal kind of economic direction of North Korea, and then the way it deals with the outside world. One thing that I think is fairly obvious, the approach that the U.S. and South Korea are taking now toward the North is only encouraging North Korea's further integration into the Chinese orbit. And I'm not sure if that's really in the interest of the U.S., of South Korea, or even of North Korea, which really I think would prefer not to be so close to China. Yes, over there. And then I'll get you.
Isaac Kim from JP Morgan.
Thank you.
The issue with the northern boundary line seems to me a legitimate issue that can be discussed in international court of justice.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there doesn't seem to be any any voice being raised in that regard. And that seems to me being rejected from the international community, and the shelling of the island might have been kind of a way of frustration. And also, you show the photograph of the dark northern side. And I think initially, when the United States came out with the accusing North Korea having developed the nuclear weapons, is that out of the Yongbyon research facility, there were no infrastructure delivering the power being generated. Now, it doesn't come as a cheap. The infrastructure itself costs billions of dollars. And I believe North Korea did try to reach out to the international banking community, for instance, like a World Bank, and yet was rejected. Do you have any background information in this regard, the North Korean attempt to reach out to the international community to resolve this type of issues?
Certainly, one of the North Korea's goals in recent years has been to be able to connect to the international financial community, and that's in some ways one of its primary goals and one of its primary reasons to want to be dropped from the terrorist list and other sanctions that the U.S. has imposed. Not just to improve relations with the U.S. itself, but to enable North Korea to have access to World Bank loans and that sort of thing. And I'm not an expert on this, but North Korea is suffering from severe problems of energy, above all, which have to do with its infrastructural weaknesses. And it's very difficult to see how it can overcome those because the problems continue to compound upon each other. They're dealing with, and this is something I think a historian can comment on, they're dealing with a railway system that was largely built by the Japanese in the 1930s, a road system which is not much more recent, power plants which are obsolete, and energy sources that are very limited and mostly coming now from China. Again, there seemed to be some real hope that there would be an opening in this regard 8 or 9 years ago. And North Korea is not as isolated as many people think. And there are North Korean students studying business affairs and other kinds of things in other countries, not many in the United States, well, not I won't comment on that, but mostly in China, Singapore, and elsewhere. So there is a realization. I mean, the North Koreans don't live in another universe. They understand what it is they need to improve their economy. It's just that the political constraints make it very difficult for them to actually put those into practice. But their ability to get that kind of financial assistance is extremely constrained because of their relationship with the United States being in the condition that it is. So my understanding is that the North Koreans feel that there is a lot at stake in trying to have some kind of a breakthrough, or at least that was their old feeling. Now it may have changed with the U.S. in order to to be able to get the kind of input that it needs. Oh, over here?
Yeah. I'd be interested in your view on a deeper historical context, how North Korea is possible in a context of Korean culture and history.
If what is possible?
North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
How is it possible in a context of Korean culture and history?
How is North Korea possible? Well, you know, in some ways, North Korea is more traditional than South Korea, in a strange way. It was Bertolt Brecht once said that it is not communism that is radical, it is capitalism. And, you know, capitalism certainly has transformed the South in many ways beyond recognition. There are certain elements, and I wouldn't exaggerate that, but I think there are certain elements in the way North Korea is run that are deeply rooted in Korean history, in this sort of paternalistic authority, in the kind of social stability. And one of the things that's really remarkable when you study the long run of Korean history, and Gary Ledger, you know this well, is the stability of these political regimes. And you had two dynasties in the pace of 1,000 years of Korean history. And that kind of ability to achieve a certain stable equilibrium seems to be in some ways very Korean. But North Korea is very modern too. And the way I look at it is that there are layers of history that North Korea rests upon. There is the kind of Confucian layer, the deep sort of values and behavioral patterns of traditional Korea. There is the history of Japanese colonialism, which I think is very important in the North Korean case. This highly militarized kind of totalitarian colonialism, I think, had a very profound impact on Kim Il-sung and other people who came to power in North Korea. In a certain way, Kim Il-sung became like the Japanese emperor, except the Korean version, you know, the sun god. He was called the sun, our sun, Uri Taehyung. I think that kind of symbolic leadership has certain roots in the Japanese experience as well. There is the Stalinist layer, which has a lot to do with the institutions of North Korea as they were initially established, and also, of course, to do with the cult of the leader that remains very central to North Korean ideology. And there is also the experience of the guerrillas who came to power initially in North Korea, like Kim Il-sung, in their kind of very disciplined, anti-colonial, almost xenophobic suspicion of the outside world and desire to hold on to what they saw as essential to Korean identity and autonomy. So there are various roots. There is even perhaps an element of Christianity in the kind of almost religious aspect of the cult of the Kim family, which may have to do with Kim Il-sung's own Christian background growing up in Korea and Manchuria. But I don't think North Korea is simply a kind of modern version of a traditional Korean state. I think it is very different, and even in the way that the family, you know, the family state is sort of defined. It really has to do with a modern family. Kim is the father, and the party is the mother, and the people are the children, which is literally how North Korean texts read. And that is an outcome of, I think, above all, a fusion of the experience of Japanese colonial totalitarianism and Stalinism, with you know, also elements of other aspects of the Korean tradition. North Korea is a very conservative society. I've been struck by that, especially in my early visits to North Korea. And by that I mean a resistance to kind of social change or any kind, and certainly any kind of political change, of wanting to keep things the way they are. And that conservatism, in a way, is connected to what I first mentioned, which is the deep sort of continuity and stability of Korean culture over a very long period of history. Of course, that isn't inevitable. As we've seen in South Korea, there's no country perhaps in the world which embraces change as much as South Korea does. So cultures are not fixed. It depends on the kind of historical circumstances and environment, which direction they go to. But what that has meant is that as time has gone by, North and South Korea have become more and more different, which has made the possibility of unification more and more problematic. Back there, yes.
I'm Mark Gass. I'm an independent investment advisor and member of. You described North Korea in the late 1950s. I don't think you said economic powerhouse, but you certainly said they were growing faster than South Korea.
Yes.
Where did the capital come from to build that economic base, and why did they lose the momentum and turn into the mess that they are now?
Well, the capital came from the Soviet bloc primarily. There was a huge investment of Soviet aid, hundreds of millions of rubles, primarily from the Soviet Union, but also from other Eastern European countries. East Germany gave the third largest amount, and then China the second. So it was the biggest multinational reconstruction project in the communist world by far. But the aid ran out, and it was intended to run out in the early 1960s. So that's one thing that happened. The Soviet East Bloc aid dried up. The other thing that happened is, as I said, the shift toward a more militarized economy, toward putting more resources into the military in the mid-1960s and diverting it from the civilian economy and from the development of new technologies. And also, North Korea reached the economic limits of this kind of a system, as we saw in Eastern Europe as well. In all of these kinds of centrally planned economies, there can be very significant growth in the early stages as the economies are building, especially in a kind of militarized fashion and in a reconstruction economy. But once they try to enter a stage of more sophisticated, consumer-oriented, technologically-oriented development, they all fail unless they engage in market reforms. But the problem, of course, is, as we saw in the 1970s and 80s, when these single-party states engage in economic reforms, that can lead to political consequences which undermine the regimes. And North Korea has not wanted to go that far. So that's the sort of structural answer. But the other thing that happened in the 1990s was, of course, the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of energy assistance above all, and other kinds of assistance, and the end of kind of captured markets for North Korean goods. North Korea wasn't able to get inputs from these former communist countries, and they had nothing that most other countries wanted to buy, with the exception perhaps of missiles and other kinds of military technologies. With all of that, then they were hit by a series of natural disasters in 1995 and 1996, 2 years of flooding and then drought. And that was the straw that broke the camel's back, and the whole economy collapsed at that point. Now, from what I understand, the economic situation is relatively stable. It's certainly not enviable and not good by general world standards, but it's much better than it was 10 years ago and has reached a point where it is not likely to lead to the kind of crisis that it did in the 1990s. The problem for North Korea has been for a long time, how can they get beyond this point of just bare subsistence to real economic growth and development? And they haven't found the answer to that yet. Back there. Yeah.
Good evening. I'm Alex Carino. I have two questions, if I may. Why is it called the Democratic Republic of People's Korea?
It's called the Democratic People's Republic.
Sorry, Democratic People's Republic of Korea. And the second one is, do you know if the Chinese were invited to investigate the sinking of the Chang'an? And if they weren't, why not?
Well, there were a number of people's democracies after World War II that were single-party states. There's the People's Republic of China, North Korea took on the name the Democratic People's Republic of Korea because that sounded even more impressive. Democratic, of course, meant a kind of mass participation in the political system, not democracy the way most of us in the West would understand it. There were a few others that were called, I think there are two other Democratic People's Republics that emerged at that time. I remember which they were. Was China invited to investigate the Chang'an? I don't think so. Does anybody know the answer to this question? Invited to investigate the Chang'an sinking.
Right, they had a multinational team, but the whole team was allies of the United States.
The North Koreans have asked to conduct their own investigation, which has been refused. The Russians had an investigation, looked at the evidence, and they claim that it is inconclusive. And from what I understand, the Chinese weren't really interested in looking at the evidence. They had their own opinion about what happened, and they didn't want to be dissuaded from that. The team could be accused of a certain, bias, but I really myself am not sure. I'm certainly not enough of an engineer to really evaluate the evidence on my own. But it would have seemed, reasonable to expect other parties, such as the Chinese and indeed the North Koreans, why not, to be involved in the investigation. But they weren't. It's here, second row, young man.
Thank you. My name is Andrew Kim, student at NYU. I was hoping if you could answer about the political legitimacy of the eventual successor, Kim Jong-un. From my understanding, after Kim Il-sung developed himself as a deity in North Korea, and when he chose his son, Kim Jong-il, as the second coming, it was fairly early in his regime, and there was time to legitimize the claim that Kim Jong-il is the second coming in 94 when he succeeded his father. It was already built in place that he was going to be the second next in command. But with Kim Jong-un, it seems like Kim Jong-il had three sons, and the first one was picked initially, and then now there's a changeover, and I just wanted to comment, if you could comment on that.
Well, North Korea is not exactly a monarchy. You have to be a member of the Kim family to be the leader, but you have to prove yourself. And it's not necessarily the case that the eldest son gets picked. The history of the family succession seems to go back to the early 1960s, and Kim Il-sung's concern about what would happen after he left the scene, especially after seeing what happened in the Soviet Union after the death of Stalin. And initially, there was a kind of power struggle between Kim Jong-il and his uncle, Kim Yong-ju, Kim Il-sung's younger brother. I've actually been investigating for the book I'm working on. There are a number of really interesting Soviet reports on this from the late 60s, early 70s that talk about the Kim family and the kind of competition between Kim Jong-il and his uncle over succession. And Kim Jong-il went through a series of positions beginning in the party in the early 1960s, as soon as he graduated from Kim Il-sung University, which has, by the way, a fantastic museum of the revolutionary activities of Kim Jong-il. If you ever go to visit Kim Il-sung University, it's well worth seeing. Then in 1973 or thereabouts, Kim Young-ju faded from the scene, and Kim Jong-il was more or less put forth, or it became fairly obvious that he was going to be the successor. And one of the ways you knew this, I've heard from defectors, is suddenly there were songs about Kim Jong-il. And you can read a lot. You can understand a lot about North Korea by listening to what they play on the state radio. In fact, one person told me that there were, in 1974, suddenly more songs about Kim Jong-il than about Kim Il-sung, which everyone understood to mean that Kim Jong-il was going to be the next leader. So he had quite a bit of time to prepare. He didn't really come out publicly as the successor in an official way until the October 1980 Sixth Party Congress. Therefore, he had 14 or even 20 years to prepare. And I won't go into the details and the speculation, because we really don't know that much about why Kim Jong-un apparently was chosen to be the successor, perhaps because he looks the most like Kim Il-sung. Perhaps because of his own personality. As I said, there was a struggle within the Kim family to get the imprimatur of Kim Il-sung to be chosen as the successor. Certainly the fact that Kim Jong-nam, the eldest son, got caught trying to sneak into Japan to bring his son to Disneyland made it very unlikely that he would be the successor. And he's been living in rather comfortable exile in Macau ever since. What I would guess is that Kim Jong-il is hoping to stay around long enough to build Kim Jong-un up the way he was built up by his father, Kim Il-sung, to be the legitimate successor, to have the power base within the military, within the party. And it's interesting that Kim Jong-il came up to the ranks of the party, and his positions were always with the party. Until the 1990s, whereas Kim Jong-un's positions have been with the military. The whole emphasis on Kim Jong-un's official face has been with the military, named a four-star general and on the military commission and so forth, which I think reflects the shift in power in North Korea from the party to the military in the intervening time. So I think if Kim Jong-il sticks around for a few more years, which he may very well do, then the possibility of a smooth succession to Kim Jong-un is likely. By the way, I don't think Kim Il-sung made himself a deity exactly, but he did become immortal in 1998, officially. He was named in the new constitution the eternal president. So Kim Il-sung is the only political leader who is able to rule forever, which goes well beyond dictator for life. Yes, Rhonda.
Okay, Rhonda Halbin, and I cover the UN now for Taga Zeitung, for Taz.de, and I did for All My News International. And my question is about the UN. I wondered about your response to two events that have happened in the past year, and one was the Chonin and the way that was taken up at the UN under the Mexican presidency, where there was the real effort to invite North Korea into the process and South Korea, both presenting their positions, and then North North Korea had a press conference, one of the very rare ones at the at the UN, and then the it was under the Mexican presidency that there was a real effort to have a balanced process, and then that was only the month of June, but then in July there was the presidential statement that made the effort to include the positions of both and encourage that there'd be diplomacy to settle and discussion. And then when we come to the Pyongyang situation, and that was in December, that the very tense situation, and then the Russian Federation calling for an emergency meeting. And though there wasn't any press statement at the end of that, the Russian ambassador made very clear that he thought that that South Korea was not wise to be firing into the waters at this time. And so he didn't only say the problem with North Korea, but he also said with South Korea. And so I wondered, this in light of what you say of North Korea being listened to, it just seemed these two incidents in what my watching the UN in the last 4 years is something different. And I wondered your response to these, and if you have any insight into is there something possible happening that would be helpful from the UN and the Security Council towards drawing North Korea more into the world community in terms of presenting the problems rather than having to look for a military way of dealing with them?
Well, the role of the UN is very interesting. In a certain sense, the UN was a belligerent in the Korean War, but it hasn't really been treated that way. I mean, everyone understands that it was primarily the United States that that fought on the Allied side, and the UN has not been, although it could be, and in the early days, North Korea to some extent saw it as the enemy, but the UN has come to play a much more neutral role as the UN in Korean affairs. The Security Council has tended to kind of play a negative role in the sense that in recent years, since the 2006 nuclear test, the issue has been whether or not and how strong sanctions would be imposed by the UN Security Council. And that's where Russia, China, and the United States have sort of played their roles in getting their interests into Security Council resolution. It is certainly conceivable that the UN could play a more proactive and positive role in bringing North Korea into dialogue and giving North Korea a platform to talk about its positions on these issues. And certainly that happens in the General Assembly, but we have not seen that with the Security Council itself. But at the end of the day, and I also think it there are a number of actors who are outside of those with the immediate interests on the Korean Peninsula, such as Mexico, such as ASEAN, which would like to play a more mediating role. But at the end of the day, I think this, because of the nature of the Korean division and the Korean conflict, serious steps toward peace, toward resolving this conflict, can only be taken by direct dialogue among the principals involved. And that would be, at a minimum, North and South Korea, China, and the United States. So whereas the UN can play a kind of a role as a platform, I don't see the UN playing a more direct role as an actor in this conflict. Yes,
sir. Hi, my name is George. I'm a member of the society. And also, I think I want to join the DPR Korea military like a Kim Jong-un and become general on the first day. No boot camp, no push-ups, no eating military rations. I think Sweden was a neutral member of the investigation
yes.
into the sinking. But I would like to ask some historical questions. Cho Min-sik, his pseudonym Kodang,
yes.
could you expound a little bit more on him and was a Kim Il-sung installed by the USSR, and was a Kim Jong-il born in the Soviet Union? And then finally, the WikiLeaks. Can you also comment on China apparently saying they would support a unified Korea under the direction of Seoul? Thank you.
Well, I'll start with the last one, which I know the least about. But from what I've read of the WikiLeaks, this is a report from the South Korean diplomat about what China said to the U.S. ambassador. So it's, first of all, secondhand. The other thing about that is I think it's a very positive sign that China is talking about contingencies. But I don't think that means China really expects this kind of a unification to happen, or that that would be their first choice. So I think there's a certain kind of spin to the way that the Chinese message is portrayed in the WikiLeaks that might not give a really accurate window into what the Chinese are thinking. They understand, of course, that this is a possibility, and they may be able to live with it if they have to, but they would prefer not to see this eventuality, I think. Cho Man-sik was a very prominent nationalist figure during the colonial period, especially in the 1920s. He was a native of the Pyongyang region. He was a Presbyterian elder. He became the head of the Pyongan province, the South Pyongan Provincial People's Committee, which was sort of an ad hoc caretaker organization following the Japanese surrender. And he was the person, you know, introduced by the Soviets when they came in, or who introduced them, and also preceded Kim Il-sung in October 1945, when there was a big public gathering in Pyongyang to show to the people who was, you know, administering the country under the Soviet occupation. He founded a party that became part of the ruling coalition in the north called the Korean Democratic Party. But he came to disagree with the Soviets in their policies and was, as I said, put under house arrest in January of 1946. Initially, as I said, from what I've seen from the Soviet materials, Kim Il-sung was sent to work with Cho Man-sik in his party, in the Korean Democratic Party, and then he was really a communist. I mean, he was much closer to the Korean communists, and then he was moved there. There was another. What was the other question about? Oh, was he born in the Soviet? Yeah, yes. I think it's pretty conclusive that he was born in the camp where Kim Il-sung retreated at the end of 1940, early 1941, near Khabarovsk. And that wasn't discussed actually in the North Korean media. The birthplace of Kim Jong-il was not an issue until after 1980, when he was presented as the heir apparent. And then there was suddenly a literature about Kim Jong-il being born on the slopes of Mount Paektu, and that hadn't existed before. So there was a real transformation in the way Kim Jong-il was portrayed, and this whole history was portrayed after 1980. Maybe here, yes.
I think you've mentioned that Kim Il-sung was raised Christian.
Yes.
Kim Il-sung was raised Christian, which is kind of always surprising to me, because at the time, I think Christianity was something that was all popular in Korea. Mm. So I'm interested to know how that came about and how did he become the way he became, which is kind of totally anti-Christian.
Well, Christianity was very popular in the Pyongyang region. That was the center where he was born and raised. South Pyongan province was the epicenter of Protestant Christianity in the early 20th century. So it's actually not surprising that he was raised Christian. His father was involved in Christian activities, but his mother was the devout one. What was her name? Bangseok, Kang Bangseok, the rock, as in the rock of Peter. So she was a deaconess in the Presbyterian Church. Presbyterianism was and remains the largest Protestant denomination in Korea. Kim Il-sung wasn't necessarily anti-Christian in the way he ran North Korea initially. In fact, his mother's cousin, Kang Young-wook, was the head of the Korean Christian Association in North Korea, and there were substantial numbers of Christian churches that were, you know, sort of regime supporters. But that was the issue that, that split the Christian community, because you had to be part of this kind of government front organization, the Korean Christian Association. Otherwise, you were, you know, ostracized. So there was about, from what statistics, the statistics I've read, about a third of the churches in the north remained kind of supporters of the regime under Kang Young-wook. And then about two-thirds became disillusioned and many left. And especially during the war, there seems to have been a step up in the persecution of Christians, partly perhaps for religious reasons, but I think more importantly because of Christians' association with the Americans, with American missionaries. So there was considerable persecution of Christians in the north shortly before the war, and then in the war, during the war, many of them fled to the south. We don't know that much about Kim Il-sung's Christian background. There is a story that he taught Sunday school for a while in his teens. And it may be that that was part of the inspiration for the kind of cult of personality, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Party. I think that is perhaps one element, but not the dominant one. We actually had a couple over here. Back there, yes.
I'm Felicia King. I teach a Cold War course at a high school.
You teach a what course?
A course on the Cold War.
In high school. Wow, that's great.
At St. Anne's School in Brooklyn.
My college students don't know what the Cold War is.
Well, they barely know. I actually have two questions. I know you're getting a lot of two-part questions. Is on your last slide, you briefly explain increasing economic contact, but not political. I was wondering between the North and South. I was wondering if you could elaborate or specify a little bit on that. And then secondly, I was under the perception, partly based on images like this or information and literature in the West, that the North is primarily closed. And I'm surprised to hear of so many scholarly exchanges. Could you elaborate on other exchanges, or if there are other like cultural exchanges? I know it opens up every once in a while. If you could just elaborate on those two, that'd be great.
Sure. There have been quite a few exchanges of across both sides, academic exchanges, historians. The Academy of Korean Studies has had a program with their North Korean counterpart, the Academy of Korean Studies in South Korea. Tourism, you know, from the south to the north, obviously not the other way around, had been pretty extensive until things basically shut down in the latter part of 2008. There was the Hyundai tours of Geumgang Mountains in the east, and then the Kaesong tour, which I took one year. I actually took one of the last Kaesong tours in November of 2008, which was really fascinating to go on a bus full of South Korean tourists to North Korea through the DMZ was quite an experience. And, you know, there have been many religious groups, Buddhists, Christians, others. There's a University of Science and Technology that recently opened in Pyongyang, which is funded entirely by Korean Christian donations. There's a lot. Actually, even now, in a state of greater tension than 2 years ago, quite a bit going on that we often don't know. The tourism has stopped, and a lot of the business investments have been suspended, but they haven't been eliminated. The Kaesong Industrial Project, which is the biggest of these, the special economic area for South Korean companies to establish their offices near the city of Kaesong, was a huge concern, and still is more or less viable. And as I've said, there have been quite a few North Korean students studying abroad. I don't know the exact numbers. They've always been studying in China. Hundreds, if not thousands, of North Korean students have studied in every year have been studying in China. But also in places like Australia, parts of Europe. So North Korea is not as isolated as it may seem. But what I'm saying is the idea that in the near term, this kind of exposure would lead to greater social and political transformations in North Korea has not turned out to be the case. Having said that, and I haven't been to Pyongyang recently, my understanding is that there are quite visible signs of economic change within Pyongyang, of private cars being driven, taxis on the street, shops, and so on. So North Korea is changing. I think what we see in retrospect is a certain perhaps naivete in the 1990s that everyone was becoming a liberal democracy and North Korea was just a little bit more behind. And that may not be the case. North Korea has changed. North Korea will continue to change. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they will, in any near-term time frame, become a much more liberalized society. And then, yes.
Hi. Good evening, Professor. My name is Taylor Barnett. I'm from Hobart Colleges. I was wondering if you could comment on what you think China stands to gain from reunification and what it stands to gain from maintaining the status quo or doing its best to maintain the status quo, since China is such a key player, or at least Americans seem to think it's a key player in Korean affairs.
I think China is a key player. I think the mistake that a lot of Americans make is thinking that that means that the Chinese can get the North Koreans to do what they want. An even bigger mistake is to believe that the Chinese can get the North Koreans to do what we want the North Koreans to do. And the North Koreans are a very independent-minded people, an independent-minded regime. Even though China theoretically has enormous leverage over North Korea, and if they pulled the plug on their energy and food, the system would presumably collapse almost overnight. But, of course, the Chinese don't want to see that happen. They don't want to lose the leverage, whatever leverage they have there. They don't want to lose that buffer toward American power in the south. They probably don't want to see American troops up near the Yalu River as they were in the fall of 1950, of course, under different circumstances, but nevertheless, they're rather leery about that. I think right now China doesn't see a lot to be gained in Korean unification. But that doesn't necessarily mean they want the status quo. My reading of China's interest over the last 10, 15 years has been what they would like to see is a North Korea that has its regime more or less remain in place, but improves its economy considerably, becomes more open to the outside world, and is less of a problem for China and more of an asset. But the bottom line, I think, for the Chinese is they do not want to see North Korea pushed over the brink. And they're very sensitive about any actions that might lead to instability in North Korea and the kind of economic costs that would have for China, as well as I said, the kind of loss of a security buffer that they seem to value as very important. And they have a tremendous economic interest in the South as well, which does not mean that the South has leverage over China. It actually means the opposite, because South Korea is much more dependent on China's markets, on economic cooperation with China, than China is on with South Korea. For whatever it means, I've often found it interesting that China is the only country in the world where you can look at a map of the Korean Peninsula and see two countries, Joseon in the north and Hangguo in the south. So, in effect, China has a more explicit two-Korea policy than any other country. Yes.
My name is John. I'm just visiting, I guess. I'm not the most knowledgeable, since a lot of my knowledge about, like, North Korea comes from my mom just telling me what's going on. But
she knows what's going on?
I mean, she reads a pretty biased Korean newspaper, so okay. I guess I have a lot of bias right now, but I mean, I think it's pretty clear that the relations, you know, like when we sit down with meetings, it always ends with broken promises. You know, like North Korea may agree to something at one point and completely just not do what they agreed to, you know. And so I'm kind of questioning, like, our strategy in dealing with the North Koreans. I mean, are we going in relations with the exact same strategy, like hoping that this time they'll finally, you know, like keep their word? Because, like, I think a big problem in North Korea is the isolation issue, the fact that the people actually don't understand what's going on in the outer world. So shouldn't our strategies be more focused upon, you know, exposing them to something other than what they know, you know, like, so I'm just wondering, like, where the strategy, like during the relations is going, like, how is it evolving, or is it really still just the same? Because it's, I mean, it's been like 50 years, you know, and I don't really think the situation has changed a lot. Cause I mean, like, even in history, like, I'm not even a history buff, but Japan used to be an isolationist nation, and we literally, like, I mean, from what I've learned in class, we, like, came barging in, you know, and made them open up to the world, you know. And so I'm wondering, like, I mean, all right, this may be completely wrong, but from what I understood, some dude came in a boat, you know, shotgun, said, I'm here, you know, like, I mean, I don't really know, but...
Yeah, okay. The dude's name was Commodore Matthew Perry.
Yeah, Matthew Perry.
And the Japanese did the same thing 22 years later with Korea and opened them up. But if I may interrupt and try to answer some of your questions, well, let me just say one thing. I absolutely agree with you. The best thing to do is to get North Korean people exposed to the outside world and to break down that barrier of ignorance. But the question is, how do you do that? And how can you do that without engaging the regime? And I don't think you can. You have to, on the one hand, do what can be done to bring information into North Korea. And actually, that is going on. There is a much more information flow in and out of North Korea now than there was 10 years ago. North Koreans are able to get broadcast from the South and get away with it, although, of course, it's illegal. There are hundreds of thousands of cell phones in North Korea that are on and off again connected to the outside world. But until you get a leadership decision to take the policy steps that will lead to a more significant and official opening up, that information flow can only extend so far. You're not going to see an uprising like in Egypt under the conditions that you have now. I mean, you may never see that, but you're certainly not going to see that in the conditions that you have now when the regime is so disconnected to the outside world. So you have to deal with it. I don't go through the history of what promises North Korea has made and broken. But it's not a complete history of failure. And North Korea has taken steps that have followed agreements that they've taken up. So, over the long run, I think that there has to be a two-pronged policy of engaging with the leadership, engaging with the government, and of bringing information through whatever means to the general population. And I think that over time, those two can come together. You've had your turn, so I'll get you next. Can I get the guy in the back?
Maybe we can have a last question. I think we have to free our speakers. Very, very generous in nearly 2 hours at the podium. Maybe, is there anyone who hasn't asked a question like to ask the last question? Just a
moment. Okay. Hi. My name's Ben Moore. I'm a member. Just curious, what is the downside? I mean, I've heard the answer to this given a lot, but I don't know if it's true. What do you see as the downside for us in just building that Berlin Wall there a little higher, camping out, being supportive of South Korea, but basically saying, okay, North Korea and its ruler, Jim Jones, Il-sung, or whoever he is China's problem. Let's let China see how long they can go on not flooding them with goods and services and a better lifestyle before that falls. And then once it falls and they get rich thanks to China, they suddenly remember they're Korean and want to reunify with South Korea. What is the downside for us in adopting that stance?
Well, the downside is that you can't keep North Korea out permanently and all the time. And I don't think that many in this country want to see North Korea continue to build its nuclear arsenal and continue to engage in provocations that could escalate into something very serious. So I don't think that simply pushing North Korea into China's embrace is the long-term solution. I think that we have to bring North Korea out, however difficult it is, and that will also bring the two Koreas together more and more, which is the ultimate wish of the Koreans on both sides. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Charles. That was and thank you very much to all of you. This is a wonderful beginning of this series. I love the numbers and the enthusiasm and the really intelligent questions. I would encourage everyone to think about, get a program, please, outside and think about coming again for the rest of the series. Our next program in this series will be next Thursday, again at 6:30, February 17th, and it's going to be Modern Korean Literature, Searching for Identity at Home and in the World, with Ann Choi Won, who will be analyzing contemporary modern Korean literature. So we hope to see you next week and at subsequent sessions of this series. We still have refreshments back here. I'm sure Charles would be happy to chat a bit, maybe follow up for a few minutes, and thank you again for coming. See you again.
The opinions expressed in the preceding program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Korea Society, its staff, management, or sponsors. Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Visit www.koreasociety.org for information about memberships and to learn more about all the programs available at the Korea Society.